I mean, we saw during the court martial of Chelsea Manning that that there are continuous attempts to link Manning to Assange under a conspiracy theory. In fact, Assange's name was brought up over 20 times in some arguments alone. So I mean, we see this over and over, and there Juan Mendez, the UN expert on torture, found that that Manning was subject to inhumane treatment while in U.S. custody, and Manning actually got sentencing credit as a result of that.
What are the rules in terms of, especially of literature? I would assume that if literature comes into the prison, it has to be reviewed if it comes in the mail by prison authorities before Manning would even get this literature. So do you know what the rules are?
I mean, based on the reports I've read, the Vanity Fair came through like normal mail. There's no reason, it seemed, to do this. In fact, Manning was asking for a lawyer when these charges happened. So it's really unacceptable. This is, like I said...
Do you see these cases as intimately linked, the cases of Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning?
In the perception of the U.S. government, absolutely. I mean, Manning is an alleged source of WikiLeaks, and one of the major theories in the Manning case was trying to link Assange to Manning. So we see, I think, based on what's happening now with Manning and the risk of torture, Assange has every right to fear being extradited to the United States.
Well, Carrie Shankman, of course, will continue to follow both of these cases. Carrie Shankman is First Amendment and human rights lawyer working along with Michael Ratner in the Center for Constitutional Rights, representing WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. And that does it for our show. A very fond farewell to our beloved senior news producer, Renee Feltz. Her humility, her brilliance, her dogged determination to unmask the truth have made Democracy Now! A better news organization. Renee, we look forward to future collaborations with you sitting at the table bringing us your invaluable reports. Well, Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Rising Film Festival, August 14th and 15th at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. The Portland Rising Film Festival will spotlight animation, transmedia, feature-length, and short films to highlight the wide range of new media content. Films include Sid Yiddish, The Girl Who Loved Animals, The Shattered Mind, and more. There will also be workshops and presentations to educate and entertain on the art and science of filmmaking. Again, that's the Portland Rising Film Festival, August 14th and 15th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, this is John Shuck, host of Religion for Life, and this week we are going to explore spiritual maturity, levels of faith, stages of faith, and my guest is Margaret Placentra Johnston. She's the author of Faith Beyond Belief, How Good People Have Left Their Church Behind.
Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
We were born before the wind.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Center for Biological Diversity reminds us that yesterday was Earth Overshoot Day.
And a Florida Attorney General moves to block Obama's clean power plan.
State officials in the Pacific Northwest assess current water reserves during a summer of record low water levels.
Good Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 14th, 2015. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. The Center for Biological Diversity has announced that yesterday, August 13th, was the 2015 Earth Overshoot Day, the day on which human resources consumption exceeds the level of resources the Earth can produce in 1 year. This means that instead of using a year's worth of the Earth's available resources in 365 days, we use that same amount in 224 days. This year's overshoot day came 1 week earlier than last year's, indicating that our level of annual resource consumption is speeding up. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke with Lee Moyer about from the Center for Biological Diversity earlier today about this issue.
My name is Lee Moyer. I am the population organizer. I work with the Population and Sustainability Program within the center, and we work on trying to address ways that we can help wildlife and the environment.
So yesterday, August 13th, marked the 2015 Earth Overshoot Day, and I was wondering if you could you explain to our listeners what Earth Overshoot Day means to bring attention to?
Overshoot Day, let me back up a sec and say there is a certain amount of resources that the Earth can produce and replenish every year. So this is stuff, you know, like the amount of timber that can grow or the number of plants that we can eat or feed to livestock or make into clothing or whatever else we need it for. There's only a certain amount that the land and seas that are arable can create every year. And then there's the amount of resources that humans use every year. And at this point, we are using those resources far sooner than the end of the year. So essentially, it's like having a budget, and we are spending well beyond our means.
In the Center for Biological Diversity's press release that I was reading, it says that this year's overshoot comes 4.5 months too soon and a week earlier than it did last year. Could you explain how the mechanics of this works?
Yeah, it's actually a fairly simple equation. So it's you take the, I believe it's the ecological resources of the planet and divide it by humans' humanity's footprint, and multiply that by 365, and you're going to get a number. This year it was 244, and that's how many days those resources will last. And so then when you put that on a calendar, it lines up and you can see, oh, this year we're going to, you know, be in overshoot on August 13th. Last year we had, I don't know, 10 more days. We were in overshoot on August 19th. So, or 6 more days. I can do math.
Well, I feel like this way of understanding, this way of kind of framing the impact of human civilization on the planetary ecosystem is very useful and very telling, because it really demonstrates the incompatibility between the Earth's finite resources and the dramatic increase in human resource consumption over the last century that we've all kind of become really used to and taken for granted. And as of right now, as your press release stated, we're using the equivalent of more than 1.5 Earth's resources. But I was wondering, what would it mean if we used only one Earth's resources within a year? Is that the definition of sustainability?
Within the context of overshoot, yes. It's having that balance between what the Earth can produce and what we use. So, yeah, if we use the resources that can be replenished in a year within a year and not any sooner, that would leave resources for other, you know, species. Wildlife is really, really feeling the push from humans taking up more and more land and using more and more resources and causing quite a few problems. You know, climate change being the big one that a lot of people talk about, but there's deforestation and other sorts of forms of habitat loss. Ocean acidification is caused also by carbon buildup in the atmosphere that then gets absorbed by the ocean, and that's, you know, causing a lot of problems for corals and other sorts of calcium-based critters. So yeah, if we can get our footprint in check and balance our budgets, it would be sustainable not only for humanity to continue to thrive, but for other species to also thrive alongside us.
I was going to ask what it would look like if we reduced our resource consumption levels to what the Earth produces in 1 year. But that would obviously require some very large cuts in fossil fuels. But what other realities would we expect to see if we were able to reduce our consumption level to what the Earth has to offer in a year?
There's a couple of solutions. I'll just talk about some of them. We waste a lot, and so cutting back on waste would be huge. We, especially in America, but in many other nations, eat a lot of meat, and it's an incredibly wasteful and high carbon usage of land, and it builds up all sorts of different things in the atmosphere. So if we cut meat out of our diet just a few days of the week, or even for just a few meals of the week, we could really start to see those changes and become closer to reaching those sustainability goals of not going over our budget in the year. And one of the biggest is population. I mean, frankly, there's a lot of us, and that's a huge part of why we've seen the Overshoot Day move forward every single year, is that every single year there are more of us. I mean, 10 years ago there were 6 billion people on Earth, and now there's 7.3 billion. And so when you're looking at finding ways to be sustainable, you really have to look back at the population. And that sounds a little scary, but when you think about in the United States, more than 50% of pregnancies are unplanned. If women, you know, and girls had access to contraceptives and, you know, education, we could potentially solve a lot of those problems without actually having to make any real change that would be uncomfortable.
So the Earth's reproducible levels of resources ran out 1 day ago, and this is kind of a simple question, but in basic terms, what does that mean we're consuming today? Are we consuming resources that cannot be renewed, or are we cutting so deeply into the things that produce those resources in the first place so that they won't be able to produce renewable resources in the future?
That's a really good question. So obviously everyone's going to have food on their plates and gasoline in their cars, and we'll have, you know, life is going to keep going on as it is. There is to some extent that we just totally deplete the resources that we have and that we don't have them anymore. But to a large extent, we're just using more than is really our fair share, and we see those the consequences being taken out on other species. So as we cut forests so we have enough timber for ourselves, we are, you know, destroying habitat. And we have seen, and scientists agree, that we are currently within the sixth mass extinction, where species are disappearing forever. I mean, this is where we really are losing. This is what overshoot is. This is what we're overdrying, is the biodiversity of the planet. And they're, you know, species are disappearing at 1,000 to 10,000 times the normal background rate, which I think is terrifying.
That was Lee Moyer with the Center for Biological Diversity, and this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
Historically low river levels and increased consumption of water because of the weather have driven Seattle, Tacoma, and Everett, Washington to implement Stage 1 of their water shortage response plan. Stage 1 consists of agencies involved requesting their customers to manage water consumption carefully, avoiding water wastage. The Portland Water Bureau, meanwhile, continues to evaluate the availability of water from Bull Run and its groundwater sources, as well as project weather forecasts and water demands to manage the local drinking water supply. Currently, there are nearly 4 billion gallons of water, or about 37% of usable storage, in the Bull Run reservoirs. While this is below the historic average, it's still above historic lows for this time of year. On July 30th, groundwater use was increased to meet total daily demand. According to the Bureau, the Bull Run supply, in combination with groundwater from the Columbia South Shore well field, can meet Portland's water needs throughout the summer.
Sure.
A Florida attorney general has joined 14 other state attorney generals in an effort to block the Obama administration's new carbon regulations on power plants that aim to cut the U.S. carbon emissions. The new regulations are called the Clean Power Plan and are expected to lower existing emissions by 30% by the year 2030. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke earlier with Andre Restrepo, an attorney for the Sierra Club, about the Attorney General's efforts to block the new regulations.
Sure. I'm Andres Restrepo, and I'm an associate attorney with the Sierra Club.
Could you briefly explain what the goals of the Obama administration's new Clean Power Plan is?
Sure. The goals of the Clean Power Plan are to reduce climate-forcing carbon dioxide pollution from existing fossil fuel-fired power plants. That's the primary motivation of these rules.
How would you characterize the benefits of the Clean Power Plan in a long-term sense?
Yeah, sure. So the Clean Power Plan is expected to result in a scenario by the year 2030 in which electric sector carbon dioxide emissions are 32% where they would have been where they were in 2005. I think something like 12 to 15% of those reductions are lower than what they would have been under a business as usual scenario. The rule is also expected to result in significant public health benefits in terms of reduced smog and soot-forming pollution that will save, I don't have the exact numbers offhand, but thousands of lives each year will result in significantly fewer asthma attacks, lost work days and school days due to illness, and will also produce, it's expected to eventually produce monetary benefits in terms of reduced electric bills for consumers.
Despite the obvious kind of health benefits to a lot of American citizens, there is kind of an expected pushback by industry companies and power plants. And recently, the Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi has joined 14 other attorney generals in an effort to block the EPA's implementation of the new plan. They say that they're wanting to block the plan, right. What does that mean? What form could that take?
So the Clean Power Plan is a regulation that's issued under the authority of the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act provides for a mechanism for judicial review, which means that any party that's affected by a particular regulation can go to court and to ask the court to review the legality of the rule. So that's what that's the mechanism that allows attorneys general to challenge the rule in court. However, one of the important things that you have to bear in mind is that this rule or these mechanisms for judicial review have some very specific procedures in place. One of them is that it only allows for final rules to be challenged, and it only allows those rules to be challenged once EPA has published the rules in the Federal Register, which is their way of making public a final action by the agency. Although EPA made issued the final rule in terms of the administrator signature came out on August 3rd, they still haven't published it in the Federal Register. So any suits or any petitions to challenge that rule in court would be premature. And so that's one of the reasons that you're seeing this pushback from attorneys general. But these lawsuits that they're filing are really just the most recent in a series of premature suits.
What is the motivation for Attorney General Pam Bondi to oppose the Clean Power Plan?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the reasons is that there's a lot of special interests at issue here. I don't know Ms. Bondi's personal involvement in any of this, but I can say that a lot of the states that are bringing suit against this are those in which that have very there's a lot of political influence by fossil fuel companies. Some of those states are ones that have relied heavily on fossil fuels in the past to generate electricity, and they might be states in which there's a lot of skepticism about the need to really tackle the problem of climate change, and in addition to the benefit of some of the public health aspects that come from reducing reliance on fossil fuels. So what we see in this situation is you see to one extent, on the one hand, you have an agency that's responding to the needs to really take action on climate change and to maximize the public health benefits that come from reducing reliance on fossil fuels. And on the other side, you have states that reflect a lot of the interests of electric utilities that have heavy investment in fossil resources. To some extent, you see the influence of fossil fuel companies. And so that's, I think that's kind of what's going on here.
Do you think there's also part of the effort to block the Clean Power Plan? Is it characterized at all by the sentiment of kind of like a states' rights defense against federal overreach?
Yeah, that's an explicit argument that a lot of these states have made. Their belief is that they think that EPA is taking too strong of an action. In this case, they think that there's overreach by the Obama administration. They're not concerned nearly as much with the health and well-being of their communities and of the problem of climate change, and they're much more interested in preserving their own authority to dictate their own electric resources in the way that they want. Our response to that is that the problem of climate change is one that does not respect state boundaries. Carbon pollution and other types of smog and soot-forming pollution that harm public health from power plants, those also don't adhere to state boundaries. This is a national and indeed a global problem. And without nationally coordinated action by EPA, we won't be able to solve our domestic problem with domestic greenhouse gas emissions, and we also won't be able to negotiate the kind of climate agreement that's necessary at the December climate negotiations in Paris.
That was Andre Restrepo, an attorney for the Sierra Club, and this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, a mother and daughter who are both community health and sexuality activists in Portland. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, 73 degrees and partly cloudy, and Sunday, 83 degrees and sunny. Today in history, in 1933, loggers unintentionally started a forest fire in the Oregon Coast Range that burned for weeks and ultimately burned down 240,000 acres of Tillamook Forest. Also, in 1947, Pakistan gained independence from Britain and joined the Commonwealth of Nations. The quote of the day is from Thomas Mann. An art whose medium is language will always show a high degree of critical creativeness. For speech is itself a critique of life. It names, it characterizes, it passes judgment. In that, it creates.
The fate of the 2019 Rugby World Cup has suffered a setback as Japan has scrapped its plans for building a huge Olympic stadium in Tokyo. Plans for the stadium intended to house the 2020 Olympic Games were canceled when the government decided predicted costs of building the stadium as designed had doubled from the $1 billion originally proposed. The stadium was to be inaugurated with the 2019 Rugby World Cup game, but with the project having to start over again, the schedule will not be able to accommodate that plan.
More than the United States, Taiwan likes to have women in government leadership positions, whereas the U.S. Congress has 20% female membership, a third of the Taiwanese legislature is female, Women also manage 10 of Taiwan's government departments, and now, for the first time, two women are squaring off against each other in January's presidential election. The main issue dividing them is China, with one candidate favoring closer ties to the mainland, the other not so much. South Korea currently has a woman president, and the prime minister of Bangladesh is female. Women have held their country's highest office in the Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, Pakistan, and India.
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Phil Graham, the former right-wing senator from Texas, has surprised me. I had assumed he had zero charitable instincts, for he kept trying to kill such poor people's programs as food assistance. "We're the only nation in the world where all our poor people are fat," he smirked. But Phil seems to have developed a new empathy for people who are demonized. Although he's now a Wall Street operative, Graham returned to Capitol Hill in July to express solidarity with victims of bigotry in our country. Wow, Graham standing with Black Lives Matter and oppressed immigrants? No, not them. The former senator was testifying against a new rule requiring corporations to reveal the spread between their CEO's pay and what their workers get. "It's demagoguery," Phil grumped. Then he lurched into the abyss of absurdity by wailing that overpaid corporate chieftains are actually, get this, victims of public bigotry. The multimillionaire snarled that the one form of bigotry that is still allowed in this country is bigotry against the successful. To prove this bizarre claim, Graham cited the specific case of his buddy Ed Whiteacre, who retired as CEO of AT&T in 2007. Ed was widely condemned for grabbing a $158 million retirement package for himself as he went out the door. Graham practically wept as he related the sad story of Whiteacre's heartache. "The guy was actually underpaid," wailed Graham. "If there's ever been an exploited worker, he was exploited. It was an outrage." Odd, since the former senator had never previously expressed the slightest concern about exploited workers. This is Jim Hightower saying, perhaps Graham could do a telethon to support ex-executives like Ed, who suffer such soul-crushing bigotry. Please give till it hurts, and don't laugh, for Phil really feels the pain of the rich.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
And now the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. UPS pilots are urging an end to different pilot safety standards between commercial and cargo flights. On the second anniversary of a UPS cargo crash that killed the pilot and first officer, the Independent Pilots Association is calling for an end to the cargo flight exemption, or carve-out, from new science-based pilot rest rules. Independent Pilots Association spokesman Brian Godet.
We had a crash 2 years ago. And one of the findings of the National Transportation Safety Board is that our pilots were fatigued. And very ironically and unfortunately, on their flight data recorder at the beginning of their flight, they were talking about how they were fatigued and how they wish this carve-out would go away or begin to apply to cargo pilots so that the schedules would be better.
Godet says the pilots union at UPS filed suit over the safety issue with a ruling expected in the case in 2016. Godet says since Congress and the FAA failed to act after that fatal crash, the pilots will use other means to get cargo pilots covered by the same safety standards as commercial passenger pilots.
It's really unfortunate that our elected officials and the FAA didn't take that to heart and change it immediately, but we have resolved that as a group, we'll get this fixed, whether it's in the courts, whether it's in Congress, or whether it's stuff that we have to negotiate in our current contract negotiations.
U.S. Representative Jen Schakowsky stood with workers Thursday at a town hall in Chicago advocating bold new policies to support working families. Representative Schakowsky and the child care workers and parents at the town hall are calling for affordable child care and a minimum $15 an hour and a union for child care workers. Matt Hoffman is a PhD adjunct professor at Loyola University, struggling with low pay himself, and he's in solidarity with low-wage workers on the child care care issue.
Fast food workers, right, they're struggling with child care. Part-time university faculty are struggling with child care. None of us have any benefits, little money. In a good year, I can make $20,000, maybe $25,000. And that income, combined with my wife's income, who also has her PhD, I mean, we can't afford child care. I was here in solidarity. I was here as, you know, a struggling parent.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics says U.S. child care workers earn a median wage of just $9.38 an hour. According to Berkeley's Center for the Study of Child Care Employment, child care workers have not seen a real rise in wages since 1997, but the costs parents are paying for child care have nearly doubled since then. As many as 46% of child care workers use some form of public support programs like food stamps and Medicaid. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says child care workers joining the Fight for 15 movement illustrates a dual crisis. Low-wage working parents are struggling to pay for child care, while child care workers struggle to support their own families. WIN is made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers and from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.immc.org, for August 8th to the 14th, 2015. Honorable's financial crisis hampers Palestinian children's school year. Meanwhile, Israeli attacks leave 2 killed civilians this week. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report, as usual, with the non-violent activities organized in the West Bank. On Friday, scores were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation when Israeli troops attacked non-violent protests organized in West Bank villages. IMEMC's Meshd Badjali with the details.
In the village of Khufr Qaddoum in northern West Bank, many residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation as Israeli troops attacked the weekly protest there. Troops later stormed the village and fired tear gas and chemical water into residents' homes. Meanwhile, in the villages of Bil'in and Na'lin in central West Bank, Israeli soldiers attacked the protesters as soon as they reached the gate in the wall that separates local